wavered, though she was obviously trying to sound unafraid, and failing miserably.
"Leandrin said we are bait."
"Bait for what?" Nynaeve asked shakily. "Bait for who? If I am bait, I'd like to shove myself down their throats till they choke on me."
"Rand..."
Egwene stopped to swallow. Even a drop of water would be welcome.
"I dreamed about Rand and Kalandor. I think he is coming here."
"But why did I dream of Matt and Perrin? It was a wolf, but I am sure it was him."
"Do not be so afraid," she said, trying to sound confident. "We will escape them somehow. If we could better the Seanchan, we can best Leandrin."
Nynaeve and Elaine exchanged looks over her. Nynaeve said, "Leandrin said 13 Myrdral are coming, Egwene." She found herself staring at that message scratched on the stone wall again. "The light have mercy and let me die." Her hands clenched into fists, her jaws cramped with the effort of not screaming those words. Better to die. Better death than being turned to the shadow, made to serve the Dark One. She realized that one of her hands had tightened around the pouch at her belt. She could feel the two rings inside, the small circle of the great serpent and the larger twisted stone ring.
"They did not take the Turangrial," she said wonderingly.
She fumbled it out of her pouch. It lay heavily on her palm, all stripes and flecks of color, a ring with only one edge.
"We were not even important enough to search," Elaine sighed. "Egwene, are you certain Rand is coming here? I would much rather free myself than wait for the chance of him, but if there is anyone who can defeat Leandrin and the rest of them, it must be him. The dragon reborn is meant to wield Kalandor. He must be able to defeat them."
"Not if we pull him into a cage after us," Nynaeve muttered. "Not if they have a trap set he does not see. Why are you staring at that ring, Egwene? Telairon Riad will not help us now, not unless you can dream a way out of here."
"Perhaps I can," she said slowly. "I could channel in Telairon Riad. Their shielding won't stop me reaching it. All I need to do is sleep, not channel, and I'm surely weary enough to sleep."
Elaine frowned, wincing as it pulled her bruises.
"I will take any chance, but how can you channel even in a dream, cut off from the true source? And if you can, how can it help us here?" "I do not know, Elaine. Just because I am shielded here does not mean I am shielded in the world of dreams. It is at least worth a try."
"Perhaps," Nynaeve said worriedly. "I will take any chance, too. But you saw Leandrin and the others the last time you used that ring, and you said they saw you, too. What if they are there again?"
"I hope they are," Egwene said grimly. "I hope they are."
Clutching the Turangrial in her hand, she closed her eyes. She could feel Elaine smoothing her hair, hear her murmuring softly. Nynaeve began to hum that wordless lullaby from her childhood. For once she felt no anger at it at all. The soft sounds and touches soothed her, let her surrender to her weariness, let sleep come. She wore blue silk this time, but she barely noticed more than that. Soft breezes caressed her unbruised face and sent the butterflies swirling above the wildflowers. Her thirst was gone, her aches. She reached out to embrace Sidar and was filled with the one power. Even the triumph she felt at succeeding was small beside the surging of the power through her. Reluctantly, she made herself release it, closed her eyes, and filled the emptiness with a perfect image of the heart of the stone. That was the one place in the stone she could picture aside from her cell, and how to distinguish one featureless cubicle from another. When she opened her eyes, she was there, but she was not alone. The form of Joya Bier stood before Kalandor, her shape so insubstantial that the surging light of the sword shone through her. The crystal sword no longer merely glittered with refracted light. In pulses it glowed, as if some light inside it were being uncovered, then covered, and uncovered again.
The Black Sister started with surprise and spun to face Egwene. How? You are shielded. Your dreaming is at an end. Before the first words were out of the woman's mouth, Egwene reached for Sayidar again, wove the complicated flow of spirit as she remembered it being used against her, and cut Joya Bier off from the source. The dark friend's eyes widened, those cruel eyes so incongruous in that beautiful, kindly face. But Egwene was already weaving air. The other woman's form might seem like mist, but the bonds held it. It seemed to Egwene that there was no effort involved in holding both flows in their weaving. There was sweat on Joya Bier's forehead as she walked closer.
"You have a Tarangreal."
Fear was plain on the woman's face, but her voice fought to hide it.
"That must be it. A Tarangreal that escaped us, and one that does not require channeling. Do you think it will do you any good, girl? Whatever you do here, it cannot affect what happens in the real world. Tell Iron Riad is a dream. When I wake, I will take your Tarangreal from you myself. Be careful what you do, lest I have reason to be angry when I come to your cell."
Egwene smiled at her.
"Are you certain you will wake, dark friend? If your Tarangreal requires channeling, why did you not wake as soon as I shielded you? Perhaps you cannot wake so long as you are shielded here."
Her smile faded away. The effort of smiling at this woman was more than she could bear. "A woman once showed me a scar she received in Tel Iron Riad, dark friend. What happens here is still real when you wake." The sweat rolled down the Black Sister's smooth, ageless face now. Egwene wondered if she thought she was about to die. She almost wished she were cruel enough to do that. Most of the unseen blows she had received had come from this woman, like a pounding of fists, for no reason more than that she had kept trying to crawl away, no reason more than that she had refused to give up. "A woman who can give such beatings," she said, "should have no objections to a milder one." She wove another flow of air quickly. Joya Bier's dark eyes bulged in disbelief as the first blow landed across her hips. Egwene saw how to adjust the weaving so she did not have to maintain it. "You will remember this and feel it when you waken, when I allow you to waken. Remember this, too. If you ever even try to beat me again, I will return you here and leave you for the rest of your life." The Black Sister's eyes stared hate at her, but there was a suggestion of tears in them, too. Egwene felt a moment of shame. Not at what she was doing to Joya. The woman deserved every blow, if not for her own beating, then for the deaths in the tower. Not that, not really, but because she had spent time on her own revenge while Nynaeve and Elaine were sitting in a cell, hoping against hope that she might be able to rescue them. She tied off and set the flows of her weavings before she knew she had done it, then paused to study what she had done. 3 separate weavings, and not only had it been no trouble to hold them all at once, but now she had done something so they would maintain themselves. She thought she could remember how, too, and it might be useful. After a moment, she unraveled one of the weavings, and the dark friend sobbed as much from relief as from pain. "I am not like you," Egwene said. "This is the second time I have done something like this, and I do not like it. I am going to have to learn to cut throats instead." From the Black Sister's face, she thought Egwene meant to start learning with her. Making a disgusted sound, Egwene left her standing there, trapped and shielded, and hurried into the forest of polished redstone columns. There had to be a way down to the cells somewhere.
The stone corridor fell silent as the final dying scream was cut off by Young Bull's jaws closing on the two legs' throat, crushing it. The blood was bitter on his tongue. He knew this was the Stone of Tyr, though he could not say how he knew. The two legs lying around him, one kicking his last with Hopper's teeth buried in his throat, had smelled rank with fear as they fought. They had smelled confused. He did not think they had known where they were. They certainly did not belong in the wolf dream, but they had been set to keep him from that tall door ahead with its iron lock. To guard it, at least. They had seemed startled to see wolves. He thought they had been startled at being there themselves. He wiped his mouth, then stared at his hand with a momentary lack of comprehension. He was a man again. He was Perrin. Back in his own body, in the blacksmith's vest, with the heavy hammer at his side. "We must hurry, young bull. There is something evil near." Perrin pulled the hammer from his belt as he strode to the door. "Fael must be here." One sharp blow shattered the lock. He kicked open the door. The room was empty except for a long stone block in the middle of the floor. Fael lay on that block as if sleeping, her black hair spread out like a fan, her body so wrapped in chains that it took him a moment to realize she was unclothed. Every chain was held to the stone by a thick bolt. He was hardly aware of crossing the space until his hand touched her, tracing her cheekbone with a finger. She opened her eyes and smiled up at him. "I kept dreaming you would come, blacksmith." "I will have you free in a moment, Fael." He raised his hammer, smashed one of the bolts as if it were wood.
"I was sure of it, Perrin."
As his name faded from her tongue, she faded too. With a clatter, the chains dropped to the stone where she had been.
"No!" he cried. "I found her!"
"The dream is not like the world of flesh, young bull. Here, the same hunt can have many endings." He did not turn to look at Hopper. He knew his teeth were bared in a snarl. Again he raised the hammer, brought it down with all his strength against the chains that had held Fael. The stone block cracked in two under his blow. The stone itself rang like a struck bell. "Then I will hunt again," he growled. Hammer in hand, Perrin strode out of the room with Hopper beside him. The stone was a place of men, and men, he knew, were crueler hunters than ever wolves were. Alarm gongs somewhere above sent sonorous clangs down the corridor, not quite drowning out the ring of metal on metal and the shouts of fighting men rather closer. The Aiel and the defenders, Matt suspected. Tall golden lampstands, each with four golden lamps, lined the hall where Matt was, and silk tapestries of battle scenes hung on the polished stone walls. There were even silk carpets on the floor, dark red on dark blue, woven in the Tyran maze. For once, Matt was too busy to put a price on anything.
"This bloody fellow is good," he thought, as he managed to sweep a sword thrust away from him. But the blow he aimed at the man's head, with the other end of the staff, had to turn into another block of that darting blade. "I wonder if he is one of these bloody high lords."
He also managed a solid blow at a knee, but his opponent sprang back, his straight blade raised on guard. The blue-eyed man certainly wore the puffy-sleeved coat, yellow with thread of gold stripes, but it was all undone, his shirt only half-tucked into his breeches, and his feet bare. His short-cropped, dark hair was tousled, like that of a man roused hastily from sleep. But he did not fight like it. 5 minutes ago, he had come darting out from one of the tall carved doors that lined this hall, a scabbardless sword in his hands. And Matt was only grateful the fellow had appeared in front of them and not behind. He was not the first man dressed so that Matt had faced already, but he was surely the best.
"Can you make it past me, thief catcher?" Matt called,
careful not to take his eyes off the man waiting for him with blade poised to strike. Sandar had insisted irritably on thief catcher, not thief taker, though Matt could not see any difference.
"I cannot," Sandar called from behind him. "If you move to let me by, you will lose room to swing that oar you call a staff, and he will spit you like a grunt."
"Like a what?"
"Well, think of something, tyrant. This ragamuffin is grating my nerves."
The man in the gold-striped coat sneered.
"You will be honored to die on the blade of the High Lord Darlin, peasant, if I allow it so."
It was the first time he had deigned to speak.
"Instead, I think I will have the pair of you hung by the heels, and watch while the skin is stripped from your bodies."
"I don't think I'd like that," Matt said. The High Lord's face reddened with indignation at being interrupted, but Matt gave him no time for any outraged comment. Quarterstaff whirling in a tight double-loop weave, so quick the staff blurred at the ends, he leaped forward. It was all a snarling darling could do to keep the staff from him. For the moment. Matt knew he could not keep this up very long, and if he was lucky then, it would all go back to the strike and counter-strike.
if he was lucky. But he had no intention of counting on luck this time. As soon as the High Lord had a moment to set himself in a pattern of defense, Matt altered his attack in mid-whirl. The end of the staff Darlin had been expecting at his head dipped instead to sweep his legs out from under him. The other end did strike at his head then, as he fell, a sharp crack that rolled his eyes back up in his head. Panting, Matt leaned on his staff over the unconscious High Lord.
Burn me, if I have to fight one or two more like this, I'll bloody well fall over from exhaustion. The stories did not tell you being a hero is such hard work. Nynaeve always did find a way to make me work.
Sandar came to stand beside him, frowning down at the crumpled High Lord.
He does not look so mighty lying there, he said wonderingly. He does not look so much greater than me.
Matt gave a start and peered down the hall, where a man had just gone trotting across along adjoining corridor.
Burn me. If I did not know it was crazy, I would swear that was Rand.
Sandar, you find that... He began swinging his staff up onto his shoulder and was cut off when it thudded into something. Spinning, he found himself facing another half-dressed High Lord, this one with his sword on the floor, his knees buckling and both hands to his head, where Matt's staff had split his scalp. Hastily, Matt poked him hard in the stomach with the butt of the staff to bring his hands down, then gave him another thump on the head to put him down in a heap on top of his sword.
Lucky, Sandar, he muttered. You cannot beat bloody luck. Now, why don't you find this bloody private way the High Lords take down to the cells?
Sandar had insisted there was such a stairway, and using it would avoid having to run through most of the stone. Matt did not think he liked men so eager to watch people put to the question that they wanted a quick route to the prisoners from their apartments.
Just be glad you were so lucky, Sandar said unsteadily, or this one would have killed us both before we saw him. I know the door is here somewhere. Are you coming? Or do you mean to wait for another High Lord to appear?
Lead on, Matt stepped over the unconscious High Lord.
I'm no bloody hero.
Trotting, he followed the thief catcher, who peered at the tall doors they passed, muttering that he knew it was here somewhere. Chapter 55. What is written in prophecy? Rand entered the chamber slowly, walking among the great polished red stone columns he remembered from his dreams. Silence filled the shadows, yet something called to him, and something flashed ahead, a momentary light throwing back shadow, a beacon. He stepped out beneath a great dome and saw what he sought. Kalandor, hanging hilt down in midair, waiting for no hand but that of the dragon reborn. As it revolved, it broke what little light there was into splinters, and now and then it flared as if with a light of its own. Calling him, waiting for him. If I am the dragon reborn, if I am not just some half-mad man cursed with the ability to channel, a puppet dancing for Moraine in the White Tower.
Take it, Luz Theron. Take it, Kinslayer.
He spun to face the voice. The tall man with close-cropped white hair, who stepped from the shadows among the columns, was familiar to him. Rand had no idea who he was, this fellow in a red silk coat with black stripes down its puffy sleeves and black breeches tucked into elaborately silver-worked boots. He did not know the man, but he had seen him in his dreams.
"You put them in a cage," he said. "Egwene and Nynaeve and Elaine. In my dreams. You kept putting them in a cage and hurting them."
The man made a dismissive gesture of his hand.
"They are less than nothing. Perhaps one day when they have been trained, but not now. I confess surprise that you cared enough to make them useful. But you are ever a fool, ever ready to follow your heart before power. You came too soon, Luz Theron. Now you must do what you are not yet ready for, or else die. Die knowing you have left these women you care for in my hands."
He seemed to be waiting for something, expectant.
"I mean to use them more, Kinslayer. They will serve me, serve my power, and that will hurt them far more than anything they have suffered before."
Behind Rand, Kalandor flashed, throwing one pulse of warmth against his back.
"Who are you?"
You do not remember me, do you?
The white-haired man laughed suddenly.
I do not remember you either, looking this way. A country lad with a flute case on his back. Did Ishmael speak the truth? He was ever one to lie when it gained him an inch or a second. Do you remember nothing, Luz Theron?
A name, Rand demanded.
What is your name? Call me Belal.
The Forsaken scowled when Rand did not react to the name.
Take it!
Belal snapped, throwing a hand toward the sword behind Rand.
Once we rode to war side by side, and for that I give you a chance. A bare chance, but a chance to save yourself. A chance to save those three I mean to make my pets. Take the sword, countryman. Perhaps it will be enough to help you survive me.
Rand laughed.
Do you believe you can frighten me so easily, Forsaken? Baalzamon himself has hunted me. Do you think I will cower now for you? Grovel before a Forsaken when I have denied the Dark One to his face?
Is that what you think? Belal said softly. Truly, you know nothing. Suddenly there was a sword in his hands, a sword with a blade carved from black fire.
Take it! Take Kalandor! 3,000 years while I lay imprisoned it has waited there for you. One of the most powerful Sangreal we ever made. Take it, and defend yourself, if you can.
He moved toward Rand as if to drive him back toward Kalandor, but Rand raised his own hands.
Sidene filled him. Sweet, rushing flow of the power, stomach-wrenching vileness of the taint. And he held a sword wrought from red flame, a sword with a heron mark on its fiery blade.
He stepped into the forms Lan had taught him till he flowed from one to the next as if in a dance, parting the silk. Water flows downhill, wind and rain. Blade of black fire met blade of red in showers of sparks, roars like white-hot metal shattering. Rand came back smoothly into a guard stance, trying not to let his sudden uncertainty show. A heron stood on the black blade, too, a bird so dark as to be nearly invisible. Once he had faced a man with a heron-marked blade of steel, and barely survived. He knew that he himself had no real right to the Blade Master's mark. It had been on the sword his father had given him, and when he thought of a sword in his hands, he thought of that sword. Once he had embraced death, as the warder had taught, but this time, he knew, his death would be final. Belal was better than he with the sword, stronger, faster, a true Blade Master. The Forsaken laughed, amused, swinging his blade in quick flourishes to either side of him. The black fire roared as if swift passage through the air quickened it.
You were a greater swordsman once, Luz Theron, he said mockingly. Do you remember when we took that tame sport called swords and learned to kill with it, as the old volumes said men once had? Do you remember even one of those desperate battles, even one of our dire defeats? Of course not. You remember nothing, do you? This time you have not learned enough. This time, Luz Theron, I will kill you.
Belal's mockery deepened.
Perhaps if you take Kalandor, you might extend your life a little longer. A little longer.
He came forward slowly, almost as if to give Rand time to do just that. Turn and race to Kalandor, to the sword that cannot be touched, to take it. But the doubts were still strong in Rand. Kalandor could only be touched by the Dragon Reborn. He had allowed them to proclaim him so for 100 reasons that seemed to leave him no choice at the time. But was he truly the Dragon Reborn? If he raced to touch Kalandor in truth, not in a dream, would his hand meet an invisible wall while Belal cut him down from behind? He met the Forsaken with the sword he knew, the blade of fire wrought from Sidene, and was driven back. The falling leaf met watered silk. The cat dances on the wall met the boar rushes downhill. The river undercuts the bank nearly lost him his head, and he had to throw himself inelegantly to one side with black flame brushing his hair, rolling to his feet to confront the stone falls from the mountain. Methodically, deliberately,
Bilal drove him back in a spiral that slowly tightened on Kalendor. Shouts echoed among the columns, screams, the clash of steel, but Rand barely heard. He and Bilal were no longer alone in the heart of the stone. Men in breastplates and rimmed helmets fought with swords against shadowy, veiled shapes that darted among the columns with short spears stabbing. Some of the soldiers formed a rank. Arrows flashing out of the dimness took them in the throat, the face, and they died in their line. Rand hardly noticed the fighting, even when men fell dead within paces of him. His own fight was too desperate. It took all of his concentration. Wet warmth trickled down his side. The old wound was breaking open. He stumbled suddenly, not seeing the dead man at his feet until he was lying on his back atop his flute case on the stone floor. Bilal raised his blade of black fire, snarling, "Take it! Take Kalendor and defend yourself! Take it, or I will kill you now! If you will not take it, I will slay you!"
"No!"
Even Bilal gave a start at the command in that woman's voice. The Forsaken stepped back out of the arc of Rand's sword and turned his head to frown at Moraine as she came striding through the battle, her eyes fixed on him, ignoring the screaming deaths around her.
"I thought you were neatly out of the way, woman. No matter. You are only an annoyance, a stinging fly. A bite me! I will cage you with the others and teach you to serve the shadow with your puny powers."
He finished with a contemptuous laugh and raised his free hand. Moraine had not stopped or slowed while he spoke. She was no more than 30 paces from him when he moved his hand, and she raised both of hers as well. There was an instant of surprise in the Forsaken's face, and he had time to scream, "No!" Then a bar of white flame, hotter than the sun, shot from the Aes Sedai's hands, a glaring rod that banished all shadows. Before it, Bilal became a shape of shimmering motes, specks dancing in the light for less than a heartbeat. Flecks consumed before his cry faded. There was silence in the chamber as that bar of light vanished. Silence except for the moans of the wounded. The fighting had stopped dead. Veiled men and men in breastplates alike standing as if stunned.
"He was right concerning one thing," Moraine said, as coolly serene as if she were standing in a meadow. "You must take Kalendor. He meant to slay you for it. But it is your birthright. Better by far that you knew more before your hand held that hilt. Yet you have come to the point now, and there's no further time for learning. Take it, Rand."
Whips of black lightning curled around her. She screamed as they lifted her, hurled it to slide along the floor like a sack until she came up against one of the columns. Rand stared up at where the lightning had come from. There was a deeper shadow up there, near the top of the columns. A blackness that made all other shadows look like noonday, and from it, two eyes of fire stared back at him. Slowly the shadow descended, resolving into Baalzamon, clothed in dead black, like a Myrdral's black. Yet even that was not so dark as the shadow that clung to him. He hung in the air, two spans above the floor, glaring at Rand with a rage as fierce as his eyes.
"Twice in this life I have offered you the chance to serve me living."
Flames leaped in his mouth as he spoke, and every word roared like a furnace.
"Twice you have refused and wounded me. Now you will serve the Lord of the Grave in death. Die, Luthaeren Kinslayer. Die, Randalthor. It is time for you to die. I take your soul."
As Baalzamon put forth his hand, Rand pushed himself up, threw himself desperately toward Kalendor, still glittering and flashing in midair. He did not know whether he could reach it or touch it if he did, but he was sure it was his only chance. Balzaman's blow struck him as he leapt, struck inside him, a ripping and crumpling, tearing something loose, trying to pull a part of him away. Rand screamed. He felt as if he were collapsing like an empty sack, as if he were being turned inside out. The pain in his side, the wound taken at Falma, was almost welcome, something to hang on to, a reminder of life. His hand closed convulsively on Kalendor's hilt. The one power surged through him, a torrent greater than he could believe, from Saiyadin into the sword.
The crystal blade shone brighter than even Moraine's fire had. It was impossible to look at, impossible any longer to see that it was a sword. Only that light blazed in his fist. He fought the flow, wrestled with the implacable tide that threatened to carry him, all that was really him, into the sword with it. For a heartbeat that took centuries, he hung, wavering, balanced on the brink of being scoured away like sand before a flash flood. With infinite slowness, the balance firmed. It was still as though he stood barefoot on a razor's edge above a bottomless drop. Yet something told him this was the best that could be expected. To channel this much of the power, he must dance on that sharpness, as he had danced the forms of the sword. He turned to face Baal Zemon. The tearing within him had ceased as soon as his hand touched Kalendor. Only an instant had passed, yet it seemed to have lasted forever.
"You will not take my soul," he shouted. "This time, I mean to finish it once and for all. I mean to finish it now."
Baal Zemon fled, man and shadow vanishing. For a moment, Rand stared, frowning. There had been a sense of folding as Baal Zemon left. A twisting, as if Baal Zemon had in some way bent what was. Ignoring the men staring at him, ignoring Moraine crumpled at the column base, Rand reached out, through Kalendor, and twisted reality to make a door to somewhere else. He did not know to where, except that it was where Baal Zemon had gone.
"I am the hunter now," he said,
and stepped through.
The stone shook under Egwene's feet. The stone shook. It rang. She caught her balance and stopped, listening. There was no more sound, no other tremor. Whatever had happened, it was over. She hurried on. A door of iron bars stood in her way with a lock as big as her head. She channeled earth before she reached it, and when she pushed against the bars, the lock tore in half. She walked quickly across the chamber beyond it, trying not to look at the things hanging on the walls. Whips and iron pincers were the most innocuous. With a small shutter, she pushed open a smaller iron gate and entered a corridor lined with rough wooden doors, rush torches burning at intervals in iron brackets. She felt almost as much relief at leaving those things behind as she did at finding what she sought. But which cell? The wooden doors opened easily. Some were unlocked, and the locks on the others lasted no longer than that larger lock had earlier. But every cell was empty. Of course. No one would dream themselves in this place. Any prisoner who managed to reach Tel-Iran Riad would dream of a pleasanter place. For a moment she felt something close to despair. She had wanted to believe that finding the right cell would make a difference. Even finding it could be impossible, though. This first corridor stretched on, and others joined it. Suddenly she saw something flicker just ahead of her, a shape even less substantial than Joya Bier had been. It had been a woman, though, she was sure of that. A woman seated on a bench beside one of the cell doors. The image flickered into being again and was gone. There was no mistaking that slender neck and the pale, innocent-appearing face with its eyelids fluttering on the edge of sleep. Amiko Nagoyan was drifting toward sleep, dreaming of her guard duties, and apparently toying drowsily with one of the stolen Turangrial. Egwene could understand that. It had been a great effort to stop using the one Varen had given her, even for a few days. She knew it was possible to cut a woman off from the true source, even if she had already embraced Saidar, but severing a weave already established had to be much harder than damming the flow before it began. She set the patterns of the weaving, readied them, making the threads of spirit much stronger this time, thicker and heavier, a denser weave with a cutting edge like a knife. The wavering shape of the dark friend appeared again, and Egwene struck out with the flows of air and spirit. For an instant something seemed to resist the weaving of spirit, and she forced it with all of her might. It slid into place. Amiko Nagoyan screamed. It was a thin sound, barely heard, as faint as she herself was, and she seemed almost like a shadow of what Joya Bier had been. Yet the bonds woven of air held her. She did not vanish again. Terror twisted the dark friend's lovely face. She seemed to be babbling, but her shouts were whispers too soft for Egwene to understand. Tying and setting the weaves around the Black Sister, Egwene turned her attentions to the cell door. Impatiently, she let earth flood into the iron lock. It fell away in black dust, in a mist that dissolved completely before it struck the floor. She swung open the door and was not surprised to find the cell empty except for one burning rush torch. But Amiko is bound, and the door is open. For a moment she thought of what to do next. Then she stepped out of the dream and woke to all her bruises and aches and thirst, to the wall of the cell against her back, staring at the tightly shut cell door. Of course. What happens to living things there is real when they wake. What I did to stone or iron or wood has no effect in the waking world. Nynaeve and Elaine were still kneeling beside her. Whoever is out there, Nynaeve said, screamed a few moments ago, but nothing else has happened. Did you find a way out? We should be able to walk out, Egwene said. Help me to my feet and I will get rid of the lock. Amiko will not trouble us. That scream was her. Elaine shook her head. I've been trying to embrace Sayadar ever since you left. It is different now, but I'm still cut off. Egwene formed the emptiness inside her, became the rosebud opening to Sayadar. The invisible wall was still there. It shimmered now. There were moments when she almost thought she could feel the true source beginning to fill her with the power. Almost. The shield wavered in and out of existence too fast for her to detect. It might as well have been solid. She stared at the other two women. I bound her. I shielded her. She is a living thing, not lifeless iron. She must be shielded still. Something has happened to the shield set on us, Elaine said. But Amiko is still managing to hold it. Egwene let her head sag back against the wall. I will have to try again. Are you strong enough? Elaine grimaced. To be blunt, you sound even weaker than you did before. This try took something out of you, Egwene. I am strong enough there. She did feel more weary, less strong, but it was their only chance that she could see. She said as much, and their faces said they agreed with her, however reluctantly. Can you go to sleep again so soon? Nynaeve asked finally. Sing to me. Egwene managed a smile. Like when I was a little girl. Please? Holding Nynaeve's hand with one of hers, the stone ring clasped in the other, she closed her eyes and tried to find sleep in the wordless humming tune.
The wide door of iron bars stood open, and the room beyond seemed empty of life. But Matt entered cautiously. Sandar was still out in the hall, trying to peer both ways at once, certain that a High Lord, or maybe 100 defenders or so, would appear at any moment. There were no men in the room now, and by the looks of the half-eaten meals on a long table, they had left hurriedly, no doubt because of the fighting above. And from the looks of the things in the walls, he was just as glad he did not have to meet any of them. Whips in different sizes and lengths, different thicknesses, with different numbers of tails. Pincers and tongs and clamps and irons. Things that looked like metal boots and gauntlets and helmets, with great screws all over them as if to tighten them down. Things he could not even begin to guess the use of. If he had met the men who used these things, he thought he would surely have checked that they were dead before he walked away.
Sandar, he hissed, are you going to stay out there all bloody night?
He hurried to the inner door, barred like the outer but smaller, without waiting for an answer, and went through. The hall beyond was lined by rough wooden doors and lit by the same rush torches as the room he had just left. No more than 20 paces from him, a woman sat on a bench beside one of the doors, leaning back against the wall in a curiously stiff fashion. She turned her head slowly toward him at the sound of his boots grating on the stone. A pretty young woman. He wondered why she did not move more than her head, and why even that moved as if she were half asleep. Was she a prisoner? Out in the hall? But nobody with a face like that could be one of the people who uses the things on those walls. She did look almost asleep, with her eyes only partly open, and the suffering on that lovely face surely made her one of the tortured, not a torturer.
Stop! Sandar shouted behind him. She is Aes Sedai. She is one of those who took the women you seek.
Matt froze in the middle of a step, staring at the woman. He remembered Moraine hurling balls of fire. He wondered if he could deflect a ball of fire with his quarterstaff. He wondered if his luck extended to outrunning Aes Sedai.
"Help me,"
she said faintly. Her eyes still looked nearly asleep, but the pleading in her voice was fully awake.
"Help me, please."
Matt blinked. She still had not moved a muscle below her neck. Cautiously, he stepped closer, waving to Sandar to stop his groaning about her being Aes Sedai. She moved her head to follow him, no more than that. A large iron key hung at her belt. For a moment he hesitated. "Aes Sedai," Sandar said. "Why doesn't she move?" Swallowing, he eased the key free as carefully as if he were trying to take a piece of meat from a wolf's jaws. She rolled her eyes toward the door beside her and made a sound like a cat that had just seen a huge dog come snarling into the room and knew there was no way out. He did not understand it, but as long as she did not try to stop him opening that door, he did not care why she just sat there like a stuffed scarecrow. On the other hand, he wondered if there was something on the other side worth being afraid of. If she is one of those who took Egwene and the others, it stands to reason she's guarding them. Tears leaked from the woman's eyes. Only she looks like it's a bloody half-man in there. But there was only one way to find out. Propping his staff against the wall, he turned the key in the lock and flung open the door, ready to run if need be. Nynaeve and Elaine were kneeling on the floor with Egwene apparently asleep between them. He gasped at the sight of Egwene's swollen face and changed his mind about her sleeping. The other two women turned toward him as he opened the door. They were almost as battered as Egwene.
"Burn me, burn me,"
looked at him and gaped.
"Matrim Cawthon," Nynaeve said, sounding shocked. "What under the light are you doing here?"
"I came to bloody rescue you," he said. "Burn me if I expected to be greeted as if I had come to steal a pie. You can tell me why you look as if you've been fighting bears later if you want. If Egwene cannot walk, I'll carry her on my back. There are Aiel all over the stone, or near enough, and either they are killing the bloody defenders or the bloody defenders are killing them. But whichever way it is, we had better get out of here while we bloody well can. If we can."
"Mind your language," Nynaeve told him,
and Elaine gave him one of those disapproving stares women were so good at. Neither one seemed to have her full attention in it, though. They began shaking Egwene as if she were not covered with more bruises than he had ever seen in his life. Egwene's eyelids fluttered open, and she groaned.
"Why did you wake me?" "I must understand it. If I loose the bonds on her, she will wake and I'll never catch her again. But if I do not, she cannot go all the way to sleep, and—"
Her eyes fell on him and widened.
"Matrim Cawthon, what under the light are you doing here?"
"You tell her," he told Nynaeve. "I am too busy trying to rescue you to watch my lang—"
They were all staring beyond him, glaring as if they wished they had knives in their hands. He spun, but all he saw was Julin Sandar, looking as if he had swallowed a rotten plum whole.
"They have cause," he told Matt. I betrayed them, but I had to."
This was addressed past Matt to the women.
"The one with the many honey-colored braids spoke to me, and I had to do it."
For a long moment, the three continued to stare.
"Leandrin has vile tricks, Master Sandar," Nynaeve said finally. "Perhaps you are not entirely to blame. We can apportion guilt later."
"If that is all cleared up," Matt said, "can we go now?"
It was as clear as mud to him, but he was more interested in leaving right then. The three women limped after him into the hall, but they stopped around the woman on the bench. She rolled her eyes at them and whimpered.
"Please, I will come back to the light. I will swear to obey you. With the oath rod in my hands, I will swear. Please do not—"
Matt jumped as Nynaeve suddenly reared back and swung a fist, knocking the woman completely off the bench. She lay there, her eyes closed all the way finally, but even lying on her side, she was still in exactly the same position she had been in on the bench.
"It is gone," Elaine said excitedly.
Egwene bent to rummage in the unconscious woman's pouch, transferring something Matt could not make out to her own.
"Yes, it feels wonderful. Something changed about her when you hit her, Nynaeve. I do not know what, but I felt it."
Elaine nodded.
"I felt it, too."
"I would like to change every last thing about her," Nynaeve said grimly.
She took Egwene's head in her hands. Egwene rose onto her toes, gasping. When Anive took her hands away to put them on Elaine, Egwene's bruises were gone. Elaine's vanished as quickly.
"Blood and bloody ashes," Matt growled. "What do you mean, hitting a woman who was just sitting there? I don't think she could even move."
They all three turned to look at him, and he made a strangled sound as the air seemed to turn to thick jelly around him. He lifted into the air until his boots dangled a good pace above the floor.
"Oh, burn me the power. Here I was afraid that Aes Sedai would use the bloody power on me, and now the bloody women I'm rescuing do it. Burn me!"
"You do not understand anything, Matrim Cawthon," Egwene said in a tight voice.
"Until you do understand," Nynaeve said in an even tighter, "I suggest you keep your opinions to yourself."
Elaine contented herself with a glare that made him think of his mother going out to cut a switch. For some reason, he found himself giving them the grin that had so often sent his mother after that switch.
"Burn me. If they can do this, I don't see how anybody ever locked them in that cell in the first place."
"What I understand is that I got you out of something you couldn't get yourselves out of, and you all have as much gratitude as a bloody Tauren ferryman with a toothache."
"You are right," Nynaeve said, and then his boots suddenly hit the floor so hard his teeth jarred. But he could move again. "As much as it pains me to say it, Matt, you are right."
He was tempted to answer something sarcastic, but there was barely enough apology in her voice as it was.
"Now can we go? With the fighting going on, Sandar thinks he and I can take you out by a small gate near the river."
"I am not leaving just yet, Matt," Nynaeve said.
"I mean to find Leandrin and Skinner," Egwene said, sounding almost as if she meant it literally. "All I want to do," Elaine said, "is pound Joya Byer till she squeals, but I will settle for any of them." "Are you all deaf?" he growled. "There is a battle going on out there. I came here to rescue you, and I mean to rescue you."
Egwene patted his cheek as she walked by him, and so did Elaine. Nynaeve merely sniffed. He stared after them with his mouth hanging open.
"Why didn't you say something?" he growled at the thief catcher.
"I saw what speaking earned you,"
Sandar said simply.
"I am no fool." "Well, I'm not staying in the middle of a battle," he shouted at the women.
They were just disappearing through the small barred door.
"I am leaving, do you hear?"
They did not even look back.
"Probably get themselves killed out there.
Somebody will stick a sword in them while they are looking the other way." With a snarl, he put his quarterstaff across his shoulder and started after.
"Are you going to stand there?" he called to the thief catcher. "I did not come this far to let them die now."
Sandar caught up to him in the room with the whips. The three women were already gone, but Matt had a feeling they would not be too hard to find.
"Just find the men bloody hanging in midair. Bloody women."
He quickened his pace to a trot. Perrin strode down the halls of the stone grimly, searching for some sign of Fael. He had rescued her twice more now, breaking her out of an iron cage once, much like the one that held the Aiel and Remen, and once breaking open a steel chest with a falcon worked on its side. Both times she had melted into air after saying his name. Hopper trotted by his side, sniffing the air. As sharp as Perrin's nose was, the wolf's was sharper. It had been Hopper who led them to the chest. Perrin wondered whether he was ever going to free her in truth. There had not been any sign in a long time, it seemed. The halls of the stone were empty, lamps burning, tapestries and weapons hanging on the walls, but nothing moved except himself and Hopper.
Except I think that was Rand.
It had only been a glimpse, a man running as if chasing someone.
It could not be him. It couldn't. But I think it was.
Hopper quickened his steps suddenly, heading for another set of tall doors, these clad in bronze. Perrin tried to match the pace, stumbled, and fell to his knees, throwing out a hand to catch himself short of dropping on his face. Weakness washed through him as if all his muscles had gone to water. Even after the feeling receded, it took some of his strength with it. It was an effort to struggle to his feet. Hopper turned to look at him.
"You are here too strongly, young bull. The flesh weakens. You do not care to hold on to it enough. Soon flesh and dream will die together."
"Find her," Perrin said. "That is all I ask. Find Fael."
Yellow eyes met yellow eyes. The wolf turned and trotted to the doors.
"Beyond here, young bull."
Perrin reached the doors and pushed. They did not budge.
There seemed to be no way to open them, no handles, nothing to grip. There was a tiny pattern worked into the metal, so fine his eyes almost did not see it. Falcons. Thousands of tiny falcons.
She has to be here. I do not think I can last much longer.
With a shout, he swung his hammer against the bronze. It rang like a great gong. Again he struck, and the peal deepened. A third blow, and the bronze doors shattered like glass. Within, 100 paces from the broken doors, a circle of light surrounded a falcon chained to a perch. Darkness filled all the rest of that vast chamber. Darkness and faint rustlings as of hundreds of wings. He took a step into the room, and a falcon swooped out of the murk, talons scoring his face as it passed. He threw an arm across his eyes, talons toward his forearm, and staggered toward the perch. Again and again the birds came, falcons diving, striking him, tearing him. But he lumbered on with blood pouring down his arms and shoulders, that one arm protecting the eyes he had fixed on the falcon on the perch. He had lost the hammer, he did not know where, but he knew that if he went back to search, he would die before he found it. As he reached the perch, the slicing talons drove him to his knees. He peered up under his arm at the falcon on the perch, and she stared back with dark, unblinking eyes. The chain that held her leg was fastened to the perch with a tiny lock shaped like a hedgehog. He seized the chain with both hands, careless of the other falcons that now became a whirlwind of cutting talons around him, and with his last strength, snapped it. Pain and the falcons brought darkness. He opened his eyes to stinging agony, as if his face and arms and shoulders had been sliced with 1,000 knives. It did not matter. Fail was kneeling over him, those dark, tilted eyes filled with worry, wiping his face with a cloth already soaked in his blood.
"My poor Perrin," she said softly. "My poor blacksmith. You were hurt so badly."
With an effort that caused more pain, he turned his head. This was the private dining room in the Star, and near one leg of the table lay a wooden carving of a hedgehog, broken in half.
"Fail,"
he whispered to her.
"My falcon."
Rand was still in the heart of the stone, but it was different. There were no men fighting here, no dead men, no one at all but himself. Abruptly, the sound of a great gong rang through the stone, then again, and the very stones beneath his feet resonated. A third time the booming came, but cut off abruptly, as if the gong had shattered. All was still.
"Where is this place?" he wondered. "More important, where is Baalzamun?"
As if to answer him, a blazing shaft like the one Moraine had made shot out of the shadows among the columns, straight toward his chest. His wrist twisted the sword instinctively. It was instinct as much as anything else that made him loose flows from Sidene into Kalendor. A flood of the power that made the sword blaze brighter even than that bar streaking at him. His uncertain balance between existence and destruction wavered. Surely that torrent would consume him. The shaft of light struck the blade of Kalendor and parted on its edge, forking to stream past on either side. He felt his coat singe from its near passage, smelled the wool beginning to burn. Behind him, the two prongs of frozen fire, of liquid light, struck huge redstone columns. Where they struck, stone ceased to exist, and the burning bars bored through to other columns, serving those instantaneously as well. The heart of the stone rumbled as columns fell and shattered in clouds of dust, sprays of stone fragments. What fell into the light, however, simply was not anymore. A snarl of rage came from the shadows, and the blazing shaft of pure white heat vanished. Rand swung Kalendor as if he were striking at something in front of him. The white light obscuring the blade extended, blazed ahead, and sheared through the redstone column that hid the snarl. The polished stone sliced like silk. The severed column trembled. Part of it tore loose and dropped from the ceiling, smashing into huge, jagged chunks on the floor. As the rumbling faded, he heard beyond it the sound of boots on stone. Running. Kalendor at the ready, Rand hurried after Baalzamun. The tall archway leading out of the heart collapsed as he reached it,
the entire wall falling into clouds of dust and rock, as if to bury him. But he threw the power at it, and all became dust floating in the air. He ran on. He was not sure what he had done, or how, but he had no time to think on it. He ran after Balsamon's retreating footsteps, echoing down the halls of the stone. Myrdral and Trollox leaped out of thin air, huge bestial shapes and eyeless faces distorted with a rage to kill, in hundreds. So they jammed the hall before him and behind, scythe-like swords and blades of deadly black steel seeking his blood. Without knowing how, he turned them to vapor that parted before him and vanished. The air around him suddenly became choking soot, clogging his nostrils, shutting off breath. But he made it fresh air again, a cool mist. Flames leaped from the floor beneath his feet, spurted from the walls, the ceiling, furious jets that flashed tapestries and rugs, tables and chests, to wisps of ash, flung ornaments and lamps ahead of them as drops of molten burning gold. He smashed the fires flat, hardened them into a red glaze in the rock. The stones around him faded almost to mist. The stone faded. Reality trembled. He could feel it unraveling, feel himself unraveling. He was being pushed out of the here into some other place where nothing existed at all. Kalendor blazed in his hands like the sun till he thought it would melt. He thought he himself would melt from the surge of the one power through him, the flood that he somehow directed into sealing up the hole that had opened around him, into holding himself on the side of existence. The stone became solid again. He could not even begin to imagine what it was that he did. The one power raged inside him till he barely knew himself, till he barely was himself, till what was himself almost did not exist. His precarious stability teetered. To either side lay the endless fall, obliteration by the power that coursed through him into the sword. Only in the dance along the razor's sharp edge was there even an uncertain safety. Kalendor shone in his fist until it seemed he carried the sun. Dimly within him, fluttering like a candle flame in a storm, was the surety that holding Kalendor, he could do anything. Anything. Through endless corridors he ran, dancing along the razor, chasing the one who would slay him, the one he must slay. There could be no other end this time. This time one of them must die. That Balsamon knew it as well was clear. Always he fled, always staying ahead of sight, so that only the sounds of his flight drew Rand on. But even fleeing, he turned this Stone of Tyr that was not the Stone of Tyr against Rand, and Rand fought back with instinct and guesses and chance. Fought and ran down that knife edge in perfect balance with the power, the tool and weapon that would consume him utterly if he faltered. Water filled the halls from top to bottom, thick and black as the bottom of the sea, choking off breath. He made it air again, unknowingly, and ran on. And suddenly the air gained weight until it seemed every inch of his skin supported a mountain, squeezing in from all directions. In the instant before he was crushed to nothingness, he chose tides out of the flood of power raging through him. He did not know how or which or why. It was too fast for thought or knowing. And the pressure vanished. He pursued Balsamon, and the very air was abruptly solid rock encasing him, then molten stone, then nothing at all to fill his lungs. The ground beneath his boots pulled at him, as if every pound suddenly weighed 1,000. Then all weight vanished, so that a step left him spinning in midair. Unseen maws gaped to rip his mind from his body, to tear away his soul. He sprang each trap and ran on. What Balsamon twisted to destroy him, he made right without being aware of how. Vaguely he knew that in some way he had brought things back into natural balance, forced them into line with his own dance down that impossibly thin divide between existence and nothingness. But that knowledge was distant. All his awareness lay in the pursuit, the hunt, the death that must end it. And then he was in the heart of stone again, stalking through the rubbled gap that had been a wall. Some of the columns hung like broken teeth now, and Balsamon backed away from him, eyes burning, shadow cloaking him. Black lines like steel wires seemed to run off from Balsamon into the darkness mounding around him, vanishing into unimaginable heights and distances within that blackness.
"I will not be undone," Balsamon cried.
His mouth was fire, his shriek echoed among the columns.
"I cannot be defeated. Aid me."
Some of the darkness shrouding him drifted into his hands, formed into a ball so black it seemed to soak up even the light of Kalendor. Sudden triumph blazed in the flames of his eyes.